Lecture 5, The Battles of Megiddo and Kadesh.
Last time we examined the development of Egyptian warfare from the Old to the New Kingdoms. Here we turn to our first specific engagements. The Egyptian records about the battles of Megiddo in the 15th century and of Kadesh in the 13th century BC are the first examples of battle narratives we have to read, insofar as they describe the background and lead up to the battle, how the armies behaved, and the aftermath. However, gaps remain, as we shall see. Imperial aggression by New Kingdom Egypt against Asiatics provides the background for Megiddo. Thutmose III, who ruled between 1504 and 1452 BC, was one of the empire's founders. The New Kingdom had been forged in war. It was to persist in the celebration of the martial ethos for its entire duration. So having reunited Egypt after the Hyksos domination, the pharaohs turned their attention to expansion abroad. For the first 22 years of his reign, the young Thutmose was usurped by the dowager queen Hatshepsut. But after a brief period of joint rule, Thutmose emerged as sole ruler and led annual campaigns into Palestine for the following 17 years. The motives for these campaigns are not obvious. The official version claims that the first campaign was launched against those plotting to attack at Egypt's borders, quote-unquote. In other words, the campaign is presented as defensive in intent. But there are other possible motives to consider, too. Thutmose faced personal and political imperatives, principally to establish his distinct reputation in the wake of Hatshepsut's dominance. Having lived in the shadow of a woman for so long, Thutmose needed to display his pharaonic virility. As a rule, Egyptian records characterize the Asiatic enemy as treacherous or in rebellion. But how or when prior suzerainty had been established over them is left rather fuzzy. It is more likely that this language glosses a naked brand of imperialism. Certainly, the expansion of Egypt's frontiers is stated as a benefit of war. And greed cannot be ruled out as a motivation either. We are told that Thutmose campaigned, quote, to give things to those who were loyal to him, unquote. And the recording of captured loot is stated as the reason for carving the royal annals on the walls of the temple at Karnak. There is a religious factor also. The sun god Amun-Re commands Pharaoh to act and gives him victories. Expansion returns Egypt to its condition under the legendary rule of the gods, and the standards of Amun-Re are carried at the head of the army. None of the foregoing are mutually exclusive motives, of course. Indeed, a blend of benefits may have impelled Thutmose into Palestine to the battle at Megiddo. The battle was fought in Thutmose's first campaign, initiated only 3 months into the 23rd year of his reign. Since he counted the 22 years of Hatshepsut's usurpation as his own, this means that Thutmose went on campaign almost immediately upon assuming sole power. Chronological indications in the official account would place the battle sometime in April or May. The year is more difficult to determine since Egyptian chronology is hotly disputed among scholars, but a year somewhere between 1479 and 1468 BC is widely accepted. By the way, the speed with which Thutmose set out in this campaign tends to undermine the purely defensive motives for it stated in the official accounts. 3 months seems a very insufficient span for Thutmose to hear of foreign threats, muster and supply an expeditionary army, and set out to counter those threats. It seems more likely that an aggressive campaign had been planned for some time. The battle is recorded in inscriptions, principally those carved on the walls of the temple of Amun-Re at Karnak, but it is also attested in other sources from Thutmose's reign. The different accounts are largely consistent with each other and may derive from the reports of scribes attached to the army units. A tomb of one such scribe called Janini has been discovered, and he declares, and I quote, "I was the one who set down the victories which he achieved over every foreign country, put into writing as it was done," unquote. The Karnak texts also speak of records kept by individual troop commanders, so we could be dealing with eyewitness evidence in some of these accounts. Consistency, however, does not equal reliability. Royal records demand interpretive care, and the texts give us good reason for caution when, for instance, they number the enemy at millions and hundred thousands of men. I record the battle, quote, "for the magnification of his victories, to cause that his deeds of valor be related for millions of years to come, apart from the deeds of heroism which his majesty did at all times. If they were to be related altogether with their names, they would be too numerous to put them in writing," unquote. Indeed, is the only response I have for that. Throughout the text, Pharaoh was everywhere dominant and decisive, the center of the action. This situation may reflect the realities of command by a despot, but it may also be pure propaganda. The situation confronting Thutmose was as follows. A coalition of Asian lords, numbered at 330 in one account, many of them supposedly renegades from Egyptian fealty, had assembled in Palestine under the chief of Kadesh, who was never named. These forces occupied Megiddo and waited there for the Egyptians. A decisive battle in the open field was sought by both sides. The stage was set. The official records state that there were three approaches to Megiddo, a road through a narrow pass from the town of Aruna directly toward Megiddo, and two more circuitous routes to the north and south, respectively. Scouts reported that the Asiatics were deployed in front of the town. Most analysts agreed that the main Asiatic force was blocking the road from the south, which they expected the Egyptians to take, naturally enough, coming from the south. And the rest were arrayed in an arc around Megiddo, facing west. At a place called Yehem, Thutmose held a war council. The army, presumably meaning the generals, advised him to take one of the circuitous routes on strategic and tactical grounds. Taking the more direct but narrow road through Aruna risked destruction in detail as the army emerged from the pass in front of Megiddo. "Do not make us go on that difficult road," they pleaded. In the official accounts, Thutmose listens to them, but ignores their concerns, and elects to take the direct, narrower route, which in parts was only 30 feet wide. His generals, of course, agree, for a servant will be after his lord, as the annals have it. The road was so narrow that as the vanguard emerged onto the plain before Megiddo, the rear was still at Aruna, some 9 miles away. The Egyptians, led by Thutmose, then proceeded to set up a camp on the plain. We are told that the van reached the plain when the shadow turned, or around noon, and Thutmose took up his position on the plain as the seventh hour was in the course of the day, presumably 7 hours later. So the Aruna road was sufficiently narrow that the Egyptian army took at least 7 hours to decant into the plain. The generals again became worried and pleaded with Thutmose to wait for the arrival of his full force before engaging the enemy. This time he heeded their advice. The Egyptian camp was to the south of Megiddo, probably on the north side of a creek which ran across the plain. The text now becomes a series of staccato, diary-like entries, as if transcribed directly from field notes. Providing for the officials, issuing rations to the retinue, posting sentries of the army, saying to them, "Be steadfast, be steadfast, be vigilant, be vigilant." In the camp, the troops rest, feed, prepare their weapons, and wait. The chief of Kadesh would have taken this opportunity to reunite his forces and prepare for the coming battle. The next day, both armies faced off on the plain. The Egyptian battle order is given, the Asiatic order ignored. Thutmose occupied the center of the Egyptian line in his fine chariot, armor, and equipment. Northern and southern attack forces were stationed on his flanks. The Battle of Megiddo was often seen as primarily a chariot battle, but while many Asiatic chariots are mentioned, only one Egyptian chariot ever appears explicitly in the text, the fine vehicle of Thutmose himself. Another view, therefore, is that the Egyptian army was mostly infantry. However, there is mention of many horses in the march along the Aruna Road, and these must be attached to chariots, since genuine cavalry were unknown in this early era. In all likelihood, the Egyptian army was a mixed force, but the proportions of chariotry to infantry are no longer recoverable. Arrayed in their battle formation, the Egyptians advanced on the Asiatics. Of the battle itself, a minimal account is given. The Asiatic coalition broke at the mere sight of Thutmose's majesty, and this is what the text says, "Thereupon his majesty prevailed over them at the head of his army. Then they saw his majesty prevailing over them, and they fled headlong to Megiddo with faces of fear." Abandoning their chariots, the Asiatics were hauled up over the walls by their clothes. Their escape was facilitated by the indiscipline of the Egyptian troops, who were looting the enemy camp. So if this account is to be believed, there was little or no real fighting at Megiddo at all, just an effective show of force that induced one side to yield instantly. Many ancient battles, indeed, must have turned out this way. But it is possible that, in the Near Eastern tradition, the actual fighting has been glossed over as the account hastens to the point where the enemy break and run. The text, however, later indicates that only 340 live prisoners and 83 hands were taken, that is, 83 Asiatics were confirmed killed, and there is no mention, of course, of Egyptian casualties. These are minuscule losses for a losing army. We shall consider explanations for them in a moment. Since the Egyptians had missed the opportunity to annihilate their foe by looting the Asiatic camp, Megiddo had to be besieged for 7 months before surrendering. A detailed list of loot closes out the official account. Several observations are worth making about this sequence of events. The battle was a mutually agreed encounter. The Asiatics specifically waited at Megiddo for a decisive engagement with the Egyptians, and Thutmose rose to their challenge. The Syrians are presented as saying, "I shall wait here at Megiddo to fight against His Majesty." Or, in a different account, we are told that the Asiatics had come to engage with My Majesty. Megiddo was a prearranged encounter intended to settle a dispute. While the generals give the wrong advice about which road to take, and Pharaoh picks the correct option, they are allowed to speak freely, and none of them was executed or otherwise punished for proposing a plan that the Pharaoh disliked. That this first council was not pure window dressing is shown by Thutmose taking the general's advice on the second occasion, though the suggestion that he wait for the army to emerge from the narrow road before engaging the enemy is rather obvious. Though a despot, it does seem that Thutmose does not command in a wholly despotic manner. The marching order of the army is also recorded. Horse goes after horse in the van, as the text has it, which must denote chariotry, and the infantry, dubbed vaguely as the people, are in the middle and the rear. Pharaoh, of course, is at the very front with the standard of Amon-Re. Such a marching order would allow the chariots to screen the infantry as it emerged from the pass, adding to the Asiatics' difficulties. Some read into Thutmose's decision to take the shorter but more perilous Aruna road clever strategic and tactical reasoning. But Thutmose states the basis for his decision very clearly, and it is as follows. "Behold," they will say, "these enemies whom Re abominates. Has His Majesty set out on another road because he has become afraid of us? So they shall speak." In other words, Thutmose's decision was personal and political rather than strategic and tactical. He took the narrow road to save face. The complacency of the chief of Kadesh is remarkable. He doesn't seem to have scouted the Egyptian approach, and he deployed his army on the basis of an assumption that the Egyptians would approach from the south. Asiatic complacency extended even into allowing Thutmose to bring his full force onto the plain despite it taking several hours for the whole army to emerge from the pass. They even allowed the Egyptians to build a camp without interference. Now, perhaps the Egyptian records are leaving out vital details, but the annals state that the Asiatic forces were split. One force was stationed outside Megiddo, the other along the southern road. So they were tactically in no position to interfere with the Egyptians' movements. While it remains inexplicable that no scouts were sent out to locate and observe the Egyptian approach, and no efforts were made to prevent it, it would not be the last time that complacency or overconfidence has lost a battle. The Egyptian camp shows the sophistication of warfare at this time. Orders are issued to various units, weapons are greased and polished, food is rationed and distributed, and sentries are posted. Finally, the strategic and tactical details are very hazy. We are told only that the Egyptians issued forth into the plain. We are not given the Syrian battle order or even the composition of their troops. We are not told the nature of the Egyptian force or how it performed on the field. The accounts of Megiddo do not cast any light on the use of chariots and infantry. What form the fighting took, we are not told, which has allowed scholars to project onto Megiddo their preferred model of combat for this era, with freewheeling chariot gyrations being the most popular model. This view, however, seems to me to be a retrojection from the later Battle of Kadesh, which probably did feature large chariot forces, as we'll be seeing in a moment. Rather, an agnostic stance is the fairest to the evidence. We honestly don't know exactly how Megiddo was fought. The casualty figures may offer something of a clue, however. 83 Asiatic deaths and 340 captives suggest either that the fighting was very limited in scope or duration, or that little killing was done once the Syrians broke for Megiddo, since the Egyptians devoted themselves to looting their camp. A third possibility is that the armies involved were very small. Scholar Hans Gudicke, for instance, envisions a pharaonic army of not more than 1,000 strong, although most scholars would set that figure 10 or 15 times larger. So a wide variation in modern interpretations reflects the uncertainties presented in the source material itself. There is great emphasis on the loot captured and tribute exacted, all of which is enumerated in terrific detail down to specific items, which suggests on-site counting of the goodies by a scribe. So we get, for instance, 340 living prisoners and 83 hands, 2,041 horses, 191 foals, 6 stallions, One chariot worked with gold, with a body of gold belonging to that enemy. One fine chariot worked with gold belonging to the prince of Megiddo, and 892 chariots of his wretched army, total 924. One fine bronze coat of mail belonging to the enemy, and so on. Over 2,000 horses and nearly 1,000 captured Asiatic chariots, by the way, argues sharply against Giudice's view that the battle was on a very small scale. So much then for the Battle of Megiddo, the first properly recorded campaign and pitched battle in our historical records. But the uncertainties that persist in this encounter nicely illustrate the problems with the ancient data. While they appear so full and informative in some respects, they leave a lot unsaid or assumed in others. So that we know what road the Egyptians took, what form their deliberations took, what their camp was like, and so on, but we do not know how the army functioned in the field or how it gained its victory. We will have to wait until the Greeks, in fact, for the emergence of the fully developed battle narrative that includes some indication of the course of the actual fighting. But that is some way off yet. Let us turn our attention now to the second great Egyptian battle on record, the Battle of Kadesh, in the early 13th century BC. Thutmose III's campaigns in Syria-Palestine established an Egyptian presence there, but total conquest proved impossible, and diplomacy with nearby foreign powers, namely the Kingdom of the Mitanni in Mesopotamia and the Hittites in Turkey, remained a necessity. The Hittites were Egypt's main rival in the region. They were a sophisticated empire based in central Anatolia and had interests in Syria. Egyptian tensions with them came to a head at the Battle of Kadesh, fought sometime between 1285 and 1275 BC, depending on which chronological scheme for Egypt one favours. Ramesses II, also known as Ramesses the Great, was the New Kingdom's greatest pharaoh, who ruled 66 years between about 1279 and 1213 BC. Ramesses' long reign means that his monuments are among the most numerous from ancient Egypt. From the sheer profusion of accounts of it, Ramesses clearly regarded the Battle of Kadesh as one of his greatest achievements. As with the Battle of Megiddo, therefore, we have plenty of evidence. But unlike Megiddo, we also have an account from the other side, the Hittites. It is clear from these accounts that Ramesses did not win a terrific victory, but rather saved his army from total annihilation by a display of personal valour. Strategically, in fact, he lost Kadesh. Once more, the essentially personal focus of the Egyptian texts is noticeable. Ramesses is at the centre of attention, always at the heart of the action. At this stage, we should expect nothing else from the pharaonic records. But it is very interesting that a reconstruction of events not very complementary to Ramesses is possible on the basis of the information he himself provides us. Once more, propaganda does not entirely drown out the facts, though it does try to spin them positively. As presented, the Battle of Kadesh stands as the greatest chariot engagement on record. In May, Ramesses approached Kadesh from the south, his army divided into four divisions named after the gods: Amun in the van, commanded by the pharaoh himself, Re following behind that, Ptah behind Re, and Seth well to the rear. Each division appears to have been 5,000 strong, a mixture of chariotry and infantry. He crossed the river Orontes some way south of Kadesh and moved toward the plain west of the town. It is highly likely, but not stated in the sources, that the Hittites and the Egyptians had agreed on Kadesh as the place to settle their dispute. This would be consistent with what we saw at Megiddo. Two Bedouins were then brought before the pharaoh and reported, duplicitously, that the Hittite king, Muwatallis II, and his forces were far distant, over 100 miles away. They appealed to Ramesses' vanity here, saying, he fears because of pharaoh to come southward. In fact, the Hittites were lying in ambush only a few miles distant, northeast of Kadesh, and so screened from the Egyptians by the city's mass. Muwatallis commanded a force of 2,500 three-man chariots, along with unnumbered infantry. The Egyptian records report that these two Bedouins were really Hittite agents, deliberately feeding misinformation to Ramesses to grease the trap. It may be so, or it may be that Ramesses was complacent in accepting an erroneous but honest report uncritically. Neither scenario redounds to Pharaoh's credit. As the Egyptian camp was being set up, two Hittite scouts were captured. Beaten and then brought before the pharaoh, these scouts divulged the true whereabouts of their force and its huge size. More numerous are they than the sands of the shore, they said, as the official account puts it. So Ramesses must now have realized that he was in deep trouble, caught in the open, unready and outnumbered, and facing an enemy arrayed for battle. He called a council of his generals and, in a bizarre non sequitur, lectured them about bad intelligence and incompetent subordinates. He surely had more pressing concerns to face. Nevertheless, orders were issued to hurry the rest of his army along. Meanwhile, the division of Ray was some way behind, approaching the Egyptian camp on the west side of the Orontes. What happened next is debated by scholars. One side, the dominant and prevalent view, has the Hittites seeing an opening and launching a massed chariot charge across a ford on the Orontes against his division, while, as the records have it, they were marching and not expecting it, unquote. The others see the battle starting accidentally when the large party of Hittite chariots on reconnaissance happened upon the Ray Corps coming north. The Egyptians, taken off guard, panicked and ran for their camp. There was no surprise attack at Kadesh, goes this line of argument, only a chance encounter. Whatever the case, it seems unlikely that all 2,500 Hittite chariots took part in this initial engagement, as most commentators assume. For them to have done so would have required too long to cross the ford on the Orontes and still be in a position to surprise the division of Ray. But in either of these scenarios, and whatever the size of the Hittite force that did actually attack Ray Corps, the Egyptians were now in really serious trouble, with 25% of their army routed. The Ray Corps broke and ran in the face of this charge. Ramesses donned his armor, mounted his chariot, and went out to rescue the division of Ray. He claims quite clearly to have done this alone, wholly without support, and I quote, "I charged all countries while I was alone. My infantry and my chariotry having forsaken me. Not one among them stood to turn around. I swear, as Ray loves me, as my father Atum favours me, that as for every matter which his majesty has stated, I did it in truth in the presence of my infantry and chariotry," unquote. He rallied the troops and reminded them of all the benefits he had conferred on them. The texts are strident in stressing the themes of abandonment and cowardice on the part of the army and of unique courage on the part of Ramesses. The pharaoh presents himself like a superhero from a comic book who puts on a costume and single-handedly saves the day. Now, most commentators have dismissed this portrayal of events as the worst sort of pharaonic bombast. They suggest either a huge cover-up, but if so, why did Ramesses plaster Kadesh all over his monuments, sometimes even decades later? Or they suggest a suppression of pertinent facts, such as the actual presence of substantial support. Now, Ramesses probably had, at the very least, his royal guard with him, whom he could justifiably omit from mention as they accompanied him everywhere. The whole issue may be one of perspective. From Ramesses' viewpoint, he was alone facing the Hittites and in a very unready position. An astonishing display of pharaonic courage would also explain why this rather equivocal battle became a centrepiece in Ramesside commemoration. And of course, the lone Ramesses did not charge 2,500 Hittite chariots, as many think he claims to have done. He never actually says that. Rather, he probably went after the smaller chariot force harassing Ray Corps, or attacked only a part of the larger Hittite force. As all this was happening, Muwatallis, the Hittite king, ensconced inside Kadesh and watching the battle from the walls, did nothing. He committed no further forces to the developing battle. Whether out of command paralysis or vacillation or respect for the conventions of Bronze Age warfare, which expected battles to be arranged, whatever the case, he held his main forces back at this crucial moment. Had he committed them, Kadesh would undoubtedly have been a decisive Hittite victory and Ramesses' reign a very short one. Meanwhile, the Hittites had penetrated into Ramesses' camp. At this juncture, a corps of the Egyptian army arrived from the west. They are dubbed the Ne'erin, the youths, and were possibly drawn from local allies in the region. And this corps slaughtered the Hittites in the Egyptian camp. The next day, Ramesses withdrew. So ended the clash at Kadesh. The scale of this engagement is debated. Some see it as a huge encounter involving many thousands of chariots, others as a couple of rather small-scale skirmishes followed by a standoff and a negotiated settlement. Once more, apparently fulsome evidence from ancient times is open to diametrically opposite interpretations. It is clear that Kadesh was a stalemate. The Hittite records, more fragmentary than the Egyptian, state that Muwatallis defeated the Egyptians. They just make that claim outright, that we defeated the Egyptians. The Egyptian texts, in contrast, do not so much claim outright victory as imply it. One gets the impression from Ramesses' exploits that the Egyptians came off on top. However, looked at in any way objectively, the edge has to go to the Hittites. Ramesses' objective was to capture Kadesh, but he never got to fire so much as a single arrow into the place. This is because he was too busy rescuing his army from a situation that was fast developing into an utter disaster. At the strategic level, then, Kadesh was a Hittite victory. But it was not completely decisive, which led to a negotiated settlement with the next Hittite king. Remarkably, both Egyptian and Hittite versions of the non-aggression treaty that emerged from Kadesh survive and show that international posturing is not a modern preserve. These two battles offer interesting insights into military affairs at these early dates. First, pitched battles between states marshalling well-organized forces are already a feature of warfare. There is no reason to think that they only appeared in the 15th century BC at Megiddo. This was a pattern of behavior with a long prior history. In my view, it is traceable back to the vulture stele in Sumer, which itself suggests an even earlier Stone Age heritage, though it must be said that the vulture stele doesn't state that many of the battles between Umma and Lagash were actually prearranged, but one can infer that perhaps they were. Pitched battles, in fact, I would say, predate our written historical records. Second, battles are agreed upon by both sides and were intended to be decisive, in that they aim to settle an issue once and for all. It has been argued, for instance, that Mu'awatallis did not commit his chariot reserves to finish Ramesses off, since that would have contravened the accepted rules of war in the late Bronze Age. If so, we are dealing with a sophisticated international scene, as is reflected in all sorts of ways in the late Bronze Age, Near East and the Aegean. And this comes in the form of, for instance, correspondence between rulers, letters back and forth, marriage alliances, treaties, trade, and so forth. Warfare and battles were just one mode among many in which these early states interacted. But it is clear that the decisive battle was part of this world and was not an invention of the 7th century BC Greeks, as some insist. Third, infantry feature heavily in these armies. At Kadesh, the Hittite infantry played no part in the actual fighting, and in general, accounts of infantry actions in this early era are certainly vague. This has led some to believe that infantry was either underdeveloped or even possibly absent from the battlefield entirely. But this would be a mistake. Our records focus on chariots, since these were the prestige armament of the era, driven by nobles and by kings. They were also prized items of plunder, and so they are highlighted and even described in the records, as we have seen. But infantry, dubbed the people, were there, and they were there in force. This is clear in the case of Megiddo, where it took several hours for the army to emerge into the plain, and we are told that the horses, that is the chariots, were at the front and the people followed behind in column. The written focus on the prestigious chariot ought not to be read literally to imply that only chariots took part in these engagements. Finally, precise details of the actual fighting remain unclear, as do casualty figures. The reports generally tend to bypass the undecided fighting and cut straight to the rout and slaughter of the enemy. This is a consistent pattern in Near Eastern and Egyptian records, and was to remain so for millennia. We'll be seeing it again with the Assyrians in a couple of lectures. So really, we are left in the dark about how these armies function tactically. While various combat models have been suggested by modern scholars, we should be clear that any such model is really an interpretation founded on inference rather than hard fact, because the ancient sources are simply not there to tell us exactly how, say, chariots and infantry worked together on the battlefield. The focus is on the chariots, because they're the interesting and the prestige sort of vehicles, and the infantry are either not mentioned or passed over in virtual silence. So it's important to be aware that these modern scholars' models of ancient combat in these early eras are really inferences rather than hard fact. I'm not saying that these models are nonsense, it's just that their tentative nature needs to be fully appreciated. Next, we turn to even more tentative matters, the Trojan War and so-called Homeric warfare.